campaigning, that's very much based in their understanding of putting people in different identities and essentially saying that you belong to this identity or that identity. Well, Islam doesn't really have that understanding. Islam thinks about these things in terms of deeds and practices. It doesn't put someone in a tick box identity area because they do one thing or the other. So one is a lack of understanding. I also think that there is, just in general, a lack of strategic thinking and also a lack of genuine support for freedom of expression. You know, we think about the left as supporting these kind of things, but actually it doesn't think about how it wants to build a coalition to take power, to take authority. It doesn't understand in a way that I think some other parts of the left, because I wouldn't put all the left in the same category. If we look at Mick Lynch, who is the General Secretary of the RMT Union, the Rail Workers Union, he's said that actually we need to be understanding about people who are church-going or mosque-going, and they may run up with problems with people on the left, but we have to understand where they're coming from, respect their beliefs, and try to build a broad coalition. I think many people on the left, on the Western left, have a very intolerant position. They don't seem to understand the need to build coalitions. And I think there are going to be cases, and probably already have been, where they're going to, because they're so extreme on pushing their particular views on these social issues, pushing people who are their natural political allies in so many other areas into the hands of the far right, for example. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that the left needs to really tackle and consider.
Now, Mirzan, let me bring you back in on this. Let me just ask you straight up. Now, I've been associated with some left-wing activism in the past myself. I know very well what you're likely to encounter when dealing with the left. We're talking about things like atheists, staunch atheists. We're talking about people who are against all religion. We're talking about feminism, things, ideologies that might see like the hijab, the niqab as being blatantly oppressive, and even critics of Islam. You may encounter on the left. So just tell me, how can you justify, as a religious Muslim, engaging and working alongside individuals who may have this type of mindset?
I think where our main issue lies is issues to do with LGBTQ and trans and trans rights and all those kind of things. For me, my experience has been is that there are avenues within the left that are open to debate, that there are spaces within the left where you can talk about gender ideology or gender critical kind of, you know, ideas, debate them, contest them. I've always seen the left as a market and as a place of contestation. And I've had my views known about the trans issues. And my views is that we don't agree with kind of vigilante violence, or I don't agree with physical harm or oppression. But at the same time, I won't agree with lifestyles and people's form of behavior that go against my religious and philosophical beliefs. And I think from where I stand, as long as I've made myself clear where my red lines are, I've been pretty much welcomed and tolerated by some individuals, let's just say.
Well, they have it, Amar, let me come back on. I want to ask you a very similar question because, you know, to be honest with you, I'm a little bit tired of the left. I think I've reached a stage now where I'm kind of over it. Jeremy Corbyn era has gone. He was very popular with Muslims here in the UK. And I think we look at the wider left-wing world. Any Muslim politician I see who succeeds in left politics, one thing we notice from them that they have in common is that they have clearly been criticised for compromising on their Islamic traditions, on their upbringing, basically. Ilhan Omar, who have we got here? We've got the Muslim London mayor, Sadiq Khan. Hamza Yousaf is even being questioned right now whether he's left the fold of Islam because of his defence of same-gender relationships on camera to journalists. So just tell me, quite frankly, do you think that we actually can, as Muslims, really identify, say, socialists or lefties? Surely there's a big issue here.
Well, I mean, I personally do consider myself to be of the left. I would call myself a socialist. But I think that one has to be very, as a practicing Muslim, be very clear-eyed about these things. One, I think you have to understand the context within which you live, and the context, particularly being in the West, I think is different to being in a leftist in other spaces. You know, we have to understand that in large part, not all of them, but in large part, people who are, let's say, militant atheists or evangelical atheists, their ultimate aim is to acculturate us out of Islam and our belief system. Some of the old school type, the very extreme ones, might even view us as some sort of unreconstructed savages, right? But we have to understand that that is their position. There are some issues with which we can work with them, other issues in which we understand, actually, we don't agree with you on that. And I think we just have to, we have to be more confident. You know, after two decades of securitization and ideological warfare, intergenerational ideological warfare, particularly targeted at young people, we have to try to recapture an understanding that actually we do have a stake in our societies, and we, you know, if we put ourselves forward strongly and we defend our positions, unlike people like Sadiq Khan or Hamza Yousaf or whatever, I wouldn't say that, you know, the only reason they've reached that position is because they've compromised on their views. They didn't try to. They did. Well, I wouldn't say they tried in the first place to really defend their views. So we don't know what the alternative outcome would have been.
Fair enough.
People like Hamza Yousaf are very influential. Sadiq Khan. You know, I think they could have tried. They didn't try. So that, I think, is the first step. We need to understand that actually we have a stake. Let's defend our positions. And okay, some people probably will be filtered out of the process. But the only way you move the needle forward is if everyone contributes to that effort. The business of politics is the business of normalizing beliefs.
But with
that's what we have to do.
With that way of thinking, surely that means that, well, for example, we could work toe-to-toe with some right-wing thinkers because they have conservative views. I don't know, like Tommy Robinson, for example, a notorious Islamophobe, has recently said things which perhaps Muslims might agree with. He's a notorious Islamophobe, for anyone who doesn't know. But, I mean, that way of thinking, OK, let's work with the left. We know they don't like us on these issues, but let's work with them. Well, that could be applied to anyone. Why is it that we're working with the left and we're not working with the far right even?
Well,
they're conservative.
Well, I would say that actually we should be broader in terms of who we're working with. That should include people on the right. I wouldn't include people like Tommy Robinson or Stephen Yaxley-Lennon is his actual name, of course, who, as you say, is a notorious Islamophobe, is a fascist. We shouldn't be working with those sorts of people. But I think we should be trying to work now in this junction, which the left actually is quite irrelevant in Britain. It's been smashed. It's irrelevant in many parts of Europe and the rest of the Western world. We should be having strategic political alliances with people across the political spectrum. I've got no problem with that. And I think, actually, you touch on something very important, is that where we share commonalities, we should try to work with people. The important thing is, as a Muslim who's engaged in that political work, you just have to be very confident in your own belief system, and you have to be assertive in what you believe. And if they don't want to accept that, well, that's their problem.
Ms. Anne, let me bring you back in. Now, again, I want to ask you, because you know the left very well from past work that you've done. Just tell me, do you not feel as if there may be a case, examples that you've seen, of Muslims who are leaning more to left-wing politics and actually leaning away from Islam? I mean, for example, I worry that there may be sisters, for example, who are very politically active. They get caught up in socialist ideas and socialist thinkers, and they are moving away from concepts like they'll be anti-hijab, for example, but they'll be very pro-socialism, for example. And obviously the priority should be hijab here. So just tell me, have you ever seen this example? Is it something that you're concerned about at all?
I'm not sure if I can say if I've seen a large percentage or a growing percentage of Muslims leaning towards communism or atheism more. There are people from within our background who would identify themselves as communists or even atheists, but I can't comment on their religious practice prior to them joining these groups, because I frankly didn't know them back then. But what I can say is, firstly, like, communism and these kind of ideas, they're not just, you know, they're not just part of the Western world. A lot of them, there are Arab communists, you know, Arab atheists as well, Middle Eastern atheists as well, people from what we would call part and part of the Muslim world who have these ideas. I think if you have a strong religious foundation, a strong religious upbringing, if you are grounded in your religion and engaged in your religion, I think you will have a strong basis to at least theologically and philosophically counter those arguments while standing in solidarity with said groups on issues that we all agree with.
Amar, let me come back to you, because one thing which, again, I notice is that we kind of... Islam has everything for us. As Muslims, we get everything from Islam. We don't need any other ideology, surely. I mean, there's this case of a popular trend of Muslims praising left-wing anti-imperialist heroes like Che Guevara and Fidel Castro. Now, I'm not saying that they don't deserve praise. Obviously, they did a good thing for their nations, for their people, for their movements. But, I mean, Islam, we have our own heroes. We don't need to aspire to be the next Fidel Castro. We've got our own bearded heroes, surely, that we should aspire to promote, to talk about, to try and live up to their example.
Well, I agree with that, and I think that part of the problem is that there are, in the 20th and 21st century, very few examples of successful Islamic resistance movements sort of pushing forward and taking state authority and even just, you know, being able to be influential in different states. There are some of them, of course, as we know. But for the most part, I suppose people tend to praise people like Fidel Castro and, you know, people like that because they have, you know, they're very recent examples of successful anti-imperialist action. And actually, I don't think that's necessarily a problem, because if the extent of that is joining a coalition that is trying to tackle two of the greatest threats and problems for Muslims geopolitically in the world today, which is the United States of America and the State of Israel, then I think we should be allied in that. In fact, if you look at someone like Hugo Chavez, he was completely counter to some of these militant atheists. He was a, you know, practicing Catholic himself. He was a very strong ally of Iran. He used to talk about Imam Mehdi. He used to understand that Islam is actually, you know, politically very anti-imperialist and an ally. So, you know, we don't have greats like Hugo Chavez with us today on the planet, but, you know, there are examples of actually different anti-imperialist leaders across the world coming together, understanding the importance of religion in liberation. You know, some people call that liberation theology. That's got a particular trend in certain countries in Latin America. And I don't see a problem with that. Obviously, Islam is comprehensive, but it doesn't mean that we can't look to inspiring and successful movements that have managed to do things that are not necessarily contradictory or incompatible with Islam.
For sure. Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground today. There's so much more we could have discussed, but unfortunately we are running out of time. So I'll have to say thank you to you, Amar, and thank you to Mizan as well for joining us, Joe. And thank you to everyone at home. Join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam, inshallah. But for now, assalamu alaikum. علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة. The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of prophethood based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We reached this phrase in the first sermon of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahj al-Balagha, where Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about one aspect of the duties of the messengers, and that is that وَيُرِيهِمْ وَيُرُوهُمْ آيَاتِ الْمَقْدِرَةِ. One of the duties of the messengers is that they show to the people the signs of God's power. And we talked about those different examples that Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions. And one of them was that وَمِهَادٍ تَحْتَهُمْ مَوْضُوعٍ. And then he says another point, and he said وَمَعَايشَ تُحْيِيهِمْ. And those provisions that give them life. So Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about certain provisions that give people life and that enliven them. This is also one of the signs of God's power.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, one of the signs, one of the things that really makes us think about God's power is life itself. Now look here, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that amongst the signs of God's power is ma'aisha tuhyihim, those provisions that make people live. Just imagine you see a body, the person who is alive, after a certain time you see that that person has died. That person could speak, could think, could laugh, could joke, could play, could do all of these different things in life. But suddenly you see that his or her body is on the ground, motionless, not being able to do all of these things that she or he was able to do before this. You know, this should make a person realize that there is something here. There is a power. There is something that this entity had that now it doesn't have. It is some energy, some kind of a strength that was existing in this entity, but now that strength isn't there. And how does that strength come? It comes from these various provisions that God has given this entity. For example, the food that he eats, the water that he drinks or she drinks, all of these things, they kind of allow that person to continue to live. Yes, there is a soul that kind of coordinates this whole activity of life. But at the end of the day, there are the material aspects are also there that make a person continuously live. And God wants us to think that, look, how life continues to go ahead with certain things that are there in this universe that look very simple, that look very lifeless, but they are full of life. They are the ones that bring about life. Rather, they are the one of the causes, if not the main cause, they are one of the causes of the continuity of life. وَمَعَايشَ تُحْيِيهِمْ. If a person is a monotheist or a believer in God, he needs to pay attention to this aspect and understand and realize the power of God that is hidden in that thing that causes these people and these entities to continue to live. And that is when a person will truly realize that, look at all of the life that exists in the universe and look at the causes of that life and how that life thrives in this earth. All of it and all of them are aspects of God's power. Another aspects of God's power. This is an important realization. And then a person thinks about his own life also and how he has been able to go ahead in life. And also to realize the fact that the causality of that entity to give life or to allow life to continue, like water, let us say, all of this causality is because of God's power and because of its dependence on that entity, on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is an important thing that makes a believer different from an unbeliever, in that a believer now has a deeper realization about existence.
IRIB English Radio presents a detailed commentary of the Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the program Gate of Knowledge.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam after that goes on to say, وَأَجَالٍ تُفْنِيهِمْ, and one of the signs of God's power is death, the time, the specific ajal, or we call it the specific time that a person reaches when a person now no longer can continue to live. وَأَجَالٍ تُفْنِيهِمْ. Really, it's something to ponder upon. This ajal, what is it? These different ajal, these different forms of death that a person, you know, that people and human beings experience. It just is like the example that I gave you before, that this person, active person who does everything properly, suddenly now he's dead. All the functions of the body are not working now. They are not continuing to work. And whatever you do, when that time comes, you cannot give that entity life. I want you to think about this. And it happened to me also once, you know. It can happen to anyone, is it? When you have a pet at home, let's say, like a pigeon or something, and it becomes sick and you try your best to give it life, like to feed it in different ways, to give it strength, right? And you try everything. You might try, let's say, all means that are there at your disposal to bring back life to that entity. But you can see in front of you that entity is dying and you cannot do anything about it. And this is the reality of the way things work in the universe. If human beings really thought about it, they would then see and witness the power of God in the way death overcomes entities. Another thing that Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions, of course, which is very important also, وَأَوْصَى بِن تُهْرِمُهُمْ. Another sign of God's power are those things that happen to a person, certain incidents that occur on him, أَوْصَى بِن تُهْرِمُهُمْ, that make that person old, that make a person aged. That is also one of the signs of God's power, inshallah. We shall discuss this in the sessions to come. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio. وبالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. His
really in front of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we answer the questions you have regarding the upbringing of your children. And the answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified family. Well, today in our studio, we have with us Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member at Al-Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Because of you, I laugh a little harder. I cry a little less and I smile a lot more. Well, that's what I have a feeling towards my friends. And when we have such feelings towards our friends, we have responsibilities towards them. And today in our episode, we're going to talk about responsibilities towards friends. And Professor Salman Nakavi is going to help us. Professor, talking about responsibilities and making our children responsible towards so many things, friendship is a very important bond in our lives. Do we have responsibilities towards our friends?
Yes, we need to understand that, number one, it's important for us, for our children, to have friends of their same age, peers who can they can have a bonding with them, and which is beneficial to all of them. They need to have friends whom they can confide in. They need to have friends whom they can be a little feel free with them in discussing things and ideas which are important for them. So it is very important. You can't deny this. You can't say that let my child grow up without having friends. He should be in solitary confinement as far as reaching out and bonding with others is concerned. You cannot stop him from doing so, you should not stop him from doing so. Especially nowadays, a lot of parents are thinking about homeschooling. They want their children to study at home. So one of the downsides of this thing is that friendships develop in schools. Yes, the problem today is that we have difficulties in finding good friends for our children. We need to help them and assist them in developing bonds of friendship with the appropriate people.
Yeah.
We need to be concerned with the fact that, not with the fact that they're making friends, but we need to be concerned with the fact that what type of friends they are interacting with.
Yeah.
So we need to be able to teach them and to make a responsible decision, a conscious decision about what friends they need to adopt and what type of friends they need to remain aloof of.
Yeah.
So there are many things that one should find in a friend. One should be trustworthy of a person who is truthful, who is sincere, who is in his behavior of a behavior which is not abusive, not letting one down, by abusing him criticizing him or whatever. So we need people to interact with positive friends. So we need to help set some guidelines to our children, for our children to look for what in their friends. You need to set guidelines and say to your child that, look, number one, you need to find a friend who can help you improve yourself.
Exactly.
Whether it's in your studies, a friend who can help you in your studies. You can work together and become better in your studies.
Yeah.
Or in your conduct and behavior, in becoming good human beings.
Yeah.
In becoming good Muslims. Find friends whom you can pray together with. Go out together to attend majalis and gatherings which are important as religious human beings.
Yeah. So we'll discuss more things with you after a short break. Dear listener, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Professor Salman Akhavi, and we are talking about our responsibility towards our friends. While talking about friends, your friends make you actually choose the path towards the prosperity or towards success again or towards
towards disaster.
Yeah.
I mean, you can have a relationship with friends who take you into a destructive relationship. You carry out things which are not allowed, which are not permitted in society or according to our religious principles and values. They engage in activities which, if you, under peer pressure, start doing them, those things, then you will also be relegated to a very small status. So you need to make your child understand, look, you need to manage and you need to develop a group of friends who you can depend upon and rely upon to perfect yourself. And you should be in such a way that if somebody evaluates your group, he gives you high grades for that.
Yeah.
That look, what a beautiful and what a cohesive group there is who is working for the betterment of their own betterment.
Yeah.
And they're working for the betterment of the society.
Yeah.
I mean, so even at school age, even at high school age, even at college age, the friends can get together to carry out so many activities which are for the society, for the betterment of society, for improving the society,
yeah,
instead of making it a worse place to live in.
Yeah.
As a group of friends can bring about so many changes in their surroundings, in their neighborhood, in their school, in their college. They can become examples and role models of group activity for many others.
Yeah.
So we need to bring this home to our child, that you are responsible for developing good, positive relationships with other children whom you can work with, especially of your own age. And you can, you need a person, you need to be working in a group, as a team, to work, whether at studies.
Yeah.
Somebody is good in something, in some subject, the other is good in another subject, they help each other to overcome their problems and overcome their deficiencies and those things which they lack in. Or they can also become a good team in helping others out also, outside their group.
Yeah. So what is important is that it should be both ways. Like, I should not be expecting my particular friend should be having these particular qualities. He should be taking me towards the prosperity. I should also be myself feeling responsible. Whosoever I am friends with, I should be guiding them towards the right path. Well, we can discuss more on this after a short break, dear listeners. stay attuned with us.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have Professor Salman Lakhavi and we are discussing what are our responsibilities towards our friends and how do we teach that to our children? Well, Professor, there is a very beautiful verse in Surah Furqan, probably it's the verse number 28, that says, woe to me, I wish I had not taken that particular person as my khalil, as my friend. This verse teaches us a lot in itself, like your friends can actually determine the way of your prosperity and again, the way of your disaster. So we got to be very careful in choosing friends. And you had been discussing that we also, when we make friends, we have to be responsible that we don't show them some disastrous path. It's our responsibility to be leading them towards prosperity. What are your more comments on that?
Yes, we have in the holy verse of the Quran, in the Surah Fatwa, where it talks about Muhammad Rasulullah. وَالَّذِينَ مَعَهُ أَشَدَّوا عَلَى الْكُفَّارِ رُحَمَاءُ بَيْنَهُمْ. So basically the Ummah of Islam, of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, they are friends. They are bonded together in bonds of mercy and love to each other. So we need to develop a society which is based on this bonding. And the bonding is based on the faith. Innamal mu'minuna ikhwa. All faithful people, all believers are bonded in a bond of brotherhood.
Yeah.
So this brotherhood has to be developed in forms of small groups which work together. So this has to be learned from the beginning of, from a very early age. In early life, we need to be able to develop bonding with people who are going to become our friends, whom we are going to be identified with, and whom even in the day of the hereafter, the day of judgment, we will be also judged based on what types of friends we have been making. So, is making friends and bonding and having these relationships, they are very important in the development of human society and in the development of an individual. As an individual, a person who wants to excel and perfect himself in the spiritual sense and elevate himself to the proximity of Allah Almighty, these friendships have to be developed in a positive way. So we need to teach our children ourselves, we need to become examples and role models for our children in how we bond with our others.
Yeah.
And how we deal with them and how we make friends. And secondly, to give them guidelines that this is what you should be looking in a friend who is faithful, who is reliable, who is truthful, who is sincere, who is ready to sacrifice his time, his money for you and for that group. And you are ready to do the same for him. وَتَوَاسَوْ بِالْحَقِّ وَتَوَاسَوْ بِالصَّبْرِ. This is important for faithful and believing people, human beings. And تَعَوَنُوا عَلَى الْبِرِّ وَالتَّقْوَى. And وَلَا تَعَوَنُوا عَلَى الْإِسْمِ وَالْعُدْوَانِ. So we should be working together and cooperating and collaborating to carry out things which are based on taqwa.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Professor. That was all the time we had for today. Thank you for guiding us with so beautiful tips. Thank you so much to our listeners who are listening to IRIB English Radio. And if you want to listen to our programs again, you can go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. Go to the tab, COI, Call of Islam, and you'll find an archive of our programs over there. You can also listen to our small clips on the social media platforms by typing Call of Islam. Thanks so much for being with us. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way. for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Economic divide.
When it comes to banks, most people are mainly concerned with a couple of things. Can I get a loan? And the ability to withdraw their money. Well, in the U.S., these two have become serious issues for depositors, since U.S. bank failures are mounting. And while there has been a bank run, the U.S. government still refuses to acknowledge that there's a banking problem in that country. Hi, I'm Kavit Tafwai. Welcome to Economic Divide. Some of the highlights of this program: 4 bank closures in the U.S., many more are predicted. Tumbling bank shares as a result. One reason, rising interest rates. Next, taking a look at the banking crisis. Well, deposits are falling. Bank runs are happening on a more frequent basis. That is a major problem when you have runs, because then the money is being pulled out. And then the cost of keeping customers, that's on the rise. And for the banks are unable to maintain that cost. Next, the health of the U.S. economy as a whole. Rising interest rates, you have inflation, you have the banking crisis. That is obviously the two signs that are not good. And then you have a debt ceiling, which may be solved, but still it points to a dark economic downturn for the U.S.
The U.S. is facing an economic crisis. Just weeks ago, J.P. Morgan Chase took over the troubled U.S. bank First Republic in a deal brokered by regulators. First Republic had been under pressure since last month, when the collapse of 2 other U.S. lenders sparked fears about the state of the banking system. The failure of the San Francisco-based First Republic is the second largest in U.S. history and the third in the country since March. It was ranked as the 14th largest lender in the U.S. at the end of last year. Problems in the banking sector surfaced in the U.S. earlier last month when Silicon Valley Bank, which was the country's 16th largest lender, collapsed in the biggest failure of a U.S. bank since 2008. That was followed 2 days later by the failure of New York's Signature Bank. Meanwhile, the U.S. Federal Reserve has revealed that over 700 banks reported unrealized losses exceeding 50% of their capital at the end of the third quarter of 2022. Authorities say rising interest rates are creating significant unrealized losses in investment securities and, in some cases, depressing tangible equity.
Americans can rest assured that our banking system is safe. Your deposits are safe. Let me also assure you, we will not stop at this. We'll do whatever is needed.
The U.S. Fed Chair Jerome Powell has insisted that the U.S. banking system is sound and resilient, but many have expressed concerns that the U.S. banking crisis is not over and a much worse financial crisis is coming.
Time now for our social media post. First up, U.S. banks sitting on $1.7 trillion in unrealized losses. These losses are not yet reflected on the balance sheets. The study shows that many banks' assets lost 10% of their value this year due to rising interest rates. The current state of the U.S. banking system is fragile and could be at risk of a crisis. This could have a ripple effect on the financial system as a whole. Next, we went to a website, and this is about the amount of money that's being withdrawn. April 17, 2023, depositors pulled nearly $60 billion from 3 U.S. banks as Apple raises pressure. Next, we go to another date, April 1st, where this website said depositors yanked another $126 billion from U.S. banks. where it said that the depositors to have drained another $126 billion from U.S. banks during the week ending March 22nd. And this was sourced from the new Federal Reserve data. This time, the outflow came from the nation's largest institutions. And finally, three failed U.S. banks had one thing in common. It's called the KPMG. Big Four auditors work for SVB, Signature Bank, and First Republic comes under scrutiny in the aftermath of their collapse. Let's break this down based on this entry. The trio of bank failures since March has cast a pall over this KPMG's lucrative business as the largest auditor of the U.S. banking sector. In all three cases, KPMG gave the bank's financial statements a clean bill of health as recently as the end of February. So that's obviously not a good sign if the regulator is doing that. All right, let me introduce our guest for this section of the program. First, we have Paul Craig Roberts. He's a former Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury who joins us. Paul Craig Roberts, welcome to Economic Divide. When we take a look at what has happened, you have emergency meetings that are taking place. You have central banks offering credit lifelines. You have tumbling bank shares. These are all alarm bells that should be going off. Well, the question is, why are U.S. banks in trouble? I mean, it is also said that aside from the ones that have failed, many more are on the horizon.
Yes, the banks are in trouble. And the reason is, or the visible reason, the most visible reason, is the rise in interest rates. And the reason that the rise in interest rates cause the bank trouble is that for 10 years, a decade, the Federal Reserve, the central bank, kept the interest rates very, very low, practically zero. And in real terms, the rates were negative. And so the assets that banks purchased for investments, such as U.S. Treasury bonds, these assets are now depreciated by the rise in interest rates. When interest rates rises, the price of existing bonds falls. So the situation for the banks is that their assets have all been pushed down in value by the rise in interest rates, but their liabilities have not. So their liabilities now exceed their assets, and the banks are technically insolvent.
Wow, not a good condition that these banks are in based on that explanation by Paul Craig Roberts. Next up is our other guest, John Diamond. He joins us. He's the director of the Center for Public Finance at Rice University's Baker Institute. John Diamond, welcome to Economic Divide. As to why this is happening now, that's what we're trying to get at, and hopefully you can answer us. But based on the research we've done, the turmoil is part of the fallout after central banks, including in the U.S. and in the U.K., raised interest rates sharply. That's what our guest also said, where it started last year. And they did that to try to dampen down the rising prices. But is that the only reason, these rising interest rates, for the banks to fail?
I mean, that is the reason. These banks had invested in what they considered to be a very safe asset, a U.S. Treasury. They did not foresee such a large rise in interest rates. So they didn't buy, or they didn't manage the risk, the interest rate risk that's associated with those bonds correctly. Once the Fed started raising rates, that insurance became prohibitively expensive, or at least was expensive enough that they didn't get it right away. And so, yeah, the Fed raising interest rates was the major factor. Obviously, had the banks, you know, manage the risk a little better, then they wouldn't be facing such significant losses.
Time now for our Info News section of the program, where we have four news items with an economic flavor that we present to you. First up, something that's happening in the U.S., which is of grave concern, and that's U.S. bankruptcies. Big firms are filing for bankruptcy left and right. And it's just the beginning based on the source that we picked for this. The filings have laid bare just how exposed highly indebted firms are. And this comes in the wake of, guess what, interest rate hikes. It said the data from Moody's and S&P Global suggests the pain could just be getting underway and could last all this year. All right, this is a great achievement that's happening between Iran and Russia in terms of an achievement, and it regards a railway. Moscow and Tehran signed a key rail deal. The new route will help diversify international trade flows. The construction involves a rail line between the Iranian cities of Rasht and then Astara. The cost, it comes in at $1.6 billion. Also, along the lines of Russia-Iran trade, this would be about the economy of both countries to benefit from this. Russia's second largest bank, VTB, opened a branch here in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And this, in a sense, also points to de-dollarization of both countries. Now, this concerns China and West Asia in terms of the trade that's happening between the two, which is important in terms of the data. In the year 2021, trade between the countries of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, or the GCC, and then China surpassed that of the United States and Europe for the first time. And the source of that particular piece of data was the IMF, and attributed this to Beijing's pro-growth policies and West Asian region ambitious economic transformation programs. So that's that just shows how Asia as a whole and its trade relations with countries in West Asia, where we are, is progressing at a rapid pace. Next up, something that's happened in Turkey. And, of course, it's not about the elections, but it's election-related vis-a-vis its economy. Now, we know that the runoff is going to take place. When you watch this program, it may have taken place already. But in terms of Turkey's stock index, it fell after the election stalemate that happened, which it was rallying because many thought that Erdogan would actually lose. But in terms of the bets that were against Erdogan, well, obviously that failed, which shows that you cannot count Erdogan out. Many are predicting now that he will actually win in the runoff. Well, those were the, I guess, news with the economic flavor that we picked.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for our in-depth section. When it comes to banks, the depositors or customers don't care about anything except for one issue. Can they get their money out of the bank whenever they want? In other words, this is the question that we pose. Are U.S. banks safe overall? That is the focus of this in-depth section. Okay, first, let's get down to some basic facts about banking. Now, surprisingly, many don't realize that when it comes to their money and when it is deposited in a bank, well, a legal fact is that the money deposited there is actually a loan that you make to your bank for which you earn interest. The bank actually takes your money and loans it to others and makes money based upon the differential in interest rates as well as fees. Many don't know that. Then we go to this fact. If the bank is on shaky financial ground, and of course your money is sitting in that bank and it goes into things like bad loans, well, this ultimately becomes the problem of the creditor. That means you, the individual. But how is that possible, you may ask? You may say, well, it's my money and I should be able to withdraw it at any time. Yet, that is hardly the case. I want to tell you why. Here comes another term, which, again, a majority are not familiar with, particularly in the U.S. What is it called? It's called a bail-in. Definition and how it affects the rights of a depositor. Well, bail-in is another form where banks and financial institutions are rescued, where the responsibility is transferred from the taxpayers, in the case of a bailout, to the depositors. And that's you in this case, okay? Now, here's the important part. A bail-in will not actually add to the government's deficit. How, you may ask? Well, it will allow banks and financial institutions at risk of failing to take some of your deposits to bail themselves out. Did you get that? Very good. Next, how will a bail-in then likely happen? Well, with the U.S. economy heading towards some negative factors, such as a possible recession or the inflation, which is at an all-time high, and then the housing market, which is in a bubble, well, uncertainties are looming over the head of Americans. And one clear sign of all of this, U.S. banks going bankrupt as they have been. Okay, let's get more on this. Let me bring back our guest, Paul Craig Roberts, who's a former Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, rejoins us. Paul Craig Roberts, welcome back. Given the negative news on U.S. banks and the bank failures that we have been covering, we're looking at around $200 billion in bank runs that's happened so far. Is the U.S. going to face an even larger bank run, do you think? And would that lead to many bank closures? And what can the depositors do to stop that happening or preventing them from withdrawing their money, do you think?
For two reasons, depositors are withdrawing their money from the banks. Well, the way the banks have to provide the money to the depositors is to sell the assets. But the assets are depreciated, so they're not getting the amount of money that they need. And so they are all in a mess. And I think it will continue because I suspect that the Federal Reserve and the Treasury are encouraging bank failure in order that there can be more concentration in the banking system. In other words, when a bank gets in trouble, then the large banks, the banks too big to fail, they purchase that bank. And so we see growing monopolization of the banking system.
Wow, that's a very interesting point that he's making there. Let's find out what John Diamond thinks. We'll bring him back in, director of the Center for Public Finance at Rice University's Baker Institute. John Diamond, welcome back. When you take a look at the health of the U.S. economy, we'd like to find out from you how it's doing. You have a banking crisis, you have the debt ceiling problem, which probably is going to get solved, but nevertheless, even if we don't see the total breakdown in trust when it comes to things like banking deposits that are being made, we could still see how the economy is not doing well, taking a look at the bank closures, especially in things like maybe unwillingness to lend at this point. How severe an impact do these closures have on the U.S. economy?
So it's going to have a big impact. We've already seen banks pulling back on their ability or willingness to lend credit. Moving forward, how tight credit gets in the U.S. is going to depend on what happens with future interest rates, as well as what happens with this debt ceiling crisis. If the U.S. Congress and the president come to an agreement and we get this crisis behind us relatively soon, then I think we will avoid any large problems. We will just face a relatively small cost in terms of there's been a hesitancy to lend with this uncertainty on the horizon. If we push this right up to the deadline, those costs get larger the closer we get to that deadline, as credit, the cost of credit default swaps and other contracts are having to be unwound behind the scenes. If we go past the deadline without a deal, then all bets are off and we could return to something similar to a 2008 style crisis in which the whole system starts to unravel.
The banking crisis is not the only problem the U.S. is facing. As the national debt has soared, the U.S. Treasury Department has had to borrow more money to pay for government spending. The legislative curb on this borrowing is known as the debt ceiling. When the Treasury Department spends the maximum amount authorized under the ceiling, Congress must vote to suspend or raise the limit on borrowing. economists are warning of dire consequences, including a default, if Congress cannot reach an agreement on the ceiling.